Neighbors, have you ever wondered where you can find a store that truly feels like home? Well, look no further. Grange Co-op has been community-focused since 1934, and guess what? We're not just a store. We're owned by customers just like you. Yep, that's right. It's all about community here. So why choose Grange Co-op? When you shop with us, you're not just supporting a store. You're supporting a community. Grange Co-op has what you need for your home, garden, pets, and farm. Grange Co-op, where the values of yesterday meet the needs of today.
Join Aaron and Bill for We the People Radio, Sundays, noon until 2.
It's conservative talk radio with a liberal dose of humor. Get the whole story from experts around the world delivering facts rather than opinion.
Missed a show? Busy at noon? No problem. Listen to our free archives when you have time. No commercial interruptions or download restrictions. We the People Radio.
.us.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
It's not about American history anymore, and that's the crime. But the real crime here is that National Museum of American History no longer teaches America's national history.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Dr. Matthew Spaulding, Vice President of Washington Operations, Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government. We'll talk with him about a recent essay at The Hill and testimony in Washington, D.C. about what's happening at the National Museum of American History. And later on in today's episode, Hillsdale English professor Justin Jackson joins us to discuss his new book, The Elements of Analysis. We're joined by Dr. Matthew Spaulding. He is Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. Dr. Spaulding, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
Talking about some recent testimony in Washington, D.C., there's an essay at The Hill, which is titled Make American History National Again. People might not have seen your testimony, and they should, obviously. What's the story here? What's going on?
Well, this is a controversy over the Smithsonian. Smithsonian is itself a much larger set of museums in Washington, D.C. There are, I think, 13, 14, a lot. Yeah, it's a huge operation. But in particular, this deals with the Museum of National Museum of American History. Mm-hmm. And there's been some attention focused on that, especially given that this is the 250th anniversary of the country, America 250, what's there. And so as a result, there's been some growing murmuring about that. And recently, a few weeks ago, a report came out from the Domestic Policy Council of the White House, a long 200-page report, 400-some footnotes, going through an assessment of that museum. At all sorts of different levels, both very particular, very detailed, but also very broad-brushed, oftentimes based on statements of the director of the museum, and also their internal documents, their planning documents, their strategic plan and mission documents. And it's really a devastating report about something that is seems to have changed at the Smithsonian, such that it no longer really, the way I read it, it's no longer really a museum of history as we understand history, and it's especially not a museum of American history, and it's very especially not a national museum of American history. So I think that there's something deeply afoot. The report talks about where this came from and how this developed, but I find it, especially this year being the anniversary, to be deeply problematic when we consider the fact that even though it's kind of a independent, somewhat pseudo-independent entity, although it's partially under the executive branch, but it's overwhelmingly funded by Congress, which means the taxpayer.
Right.
Well, that's even more problematic. So I think the problem here is that the idea of a museum teaching American history at the Smithsonian on the National Mall, funded by Congress, and yet it's bereft of national history and the American founding and the things we associate, common person would associate with American history.
Some of the stuff is there, if I read your Hill piece correct, but there's no major narrative exhibit about the founding of the country at the nation's
History Museum. And let's parse that for a moment, because I think that's really kind of the nub of it. And sometimes we pass over that. And this is merely a differing interpretation, if you will, or this is kind of a left-right kind of thing. No, there's something much more problematic here. The great stuff are still at the Smithsonian. I mean, I remember going there as a kid in high school. The Star Spangled Banner, Lincoln's hat, top hat, and Jefferson's writing desk. Yes, those are all there. But if you have no context, that's just stuff, which is why it's often told the Smithsonian is often called America's attic. But if it's just a bunch of stuff piled in the attic, it means nothing. Well, if you think about history as a bunch of things, events, particulars, what is it gives it context? It's the narrative, the story that ties them all together and shows how it's, you know, over the course of an arc, gives it some meaning. The problem is that that's not there. Instead, what you have are all these particular things, of which there are now a lot more particular things, including a lot of things one would not associate with American history, or not appropriately that should be an American History Museum, that are all kind of thrown together and interpreted in a way that's really much very outside of that narrative. And the reason here, we can come back to this more lengthy if you'd like to, is that it gets to this deeper historical debate. The normal way to think about history is a series of events. The word chronology comes from the Greek word for, you know, chronos, from which you get chronology is history. Postmodernism, which is a much more recent 1970s, 80s thinking that now really dominates the history profession and much other academic profession, sees that as all problematic. Because that's someone imposing something on somebody else. There aren't facts and realities. There aren't truths that underlie these things. It's all interpretive. It's what you make of it. It's what you impose and use it for.
Dr. Matthew Spaulding with us. His piece at The Hill, you can read, Make American History National Again. You can also find his testimony. You have a little bit of experience with this because you helped to design, plan these freedom trucks that made their way across the country during America's 250th anniversary. And this is not the size of a museum in Washington, D.C., but the size of a truck.
Right, right.
And people could go and learn about our nation's history. How would you compare and contrast what you think you were able to accomplish with the freedom trucks compared to what you see in D.C.?
Well, one practical difference is that the trucks have gone. There are six trucks traveling the nation. A lot of people, especially school kids, have gone through them, which is great. I'm very happy about that. But the Smithsonian has millions of visitors every year. So in that sense, their scale is very different. But having said that, going back to my previous point, the main criticism of the Freedom Trucks is that it told an old story. And I remember one of the interviews I did about the Freedom Trucks, someone said, okay, well, most of what you got in the Freedom Trucks is not objectionable. Let me get to my questions. To which my response was, wait, that's exactly the point. It's to tell a story. So the Freedom Truck focuses on, you know, the pre-colonial period, the debates, the Stamp Act, the, you know, the various things we associate with the beginnings of the Revolution. And then this controversy between the Continental Congress and George III and eventually George Washington. And then the outbreak of the war, Lexington Concord, Bunker Hill, the Revolutionary War itself, Long Island, the long retreat, crossing the Delaware, eventually the victory at Yorktown. And then it talks about how out of that arose the conditions which led to the U.S. Constitution. That's a narrative. That's a story. And the criticism was, well, by telling that story, you're ignoring what should be emphasized, which is exactly juxtaposed to what the problem is at Smithsonian, which is they remove their narrative. That's not what they want to tell, among other things, because the narrative is about these individuals, many of these heroic individuals, amazing accomplishments that they did all this in the middle of us. They wrote the Declaration of Independence, declaring that all men are created equal. And then they had to aspire and live up to that, and it was not perfect by any means, but that gives a push to that narrative. Rather than telling that, they want to remove that, reframe it, or problematize it, as they say, and instead just focus on the warts. And that's really what American history becomes.
One phrase that jumped out in the argument was that the museum has gone from helping people understand history to trying to empower them to change society. And if I remember correctly, there's actually literally language that says that now.
Yes, no, that's right. As a matter of fact, one of the things the current director did very early in her directorship was they changed the mission statement of the museum. It was originally had to do with essentially presenting this great, rich American history to the visitor in order to teach them, to educate. But now the mission statement, the verb of the mission statement is to empower, to use history to empower one to seek social justice. That's kind of everything in a nutshell, if you will. But again, all their documents, their mission, their interpretive documents, everything explains this. You don't take it from me. Mm-hmm. You don't have to take it from the White House report for that matter. The White House report quotes a lot of their own statements. They make it very clear. They're not hiding anything here. And they haven't denied anything in that report, as far as I know. It's a clear juxtaposition between two views of history.
Dr. Matthew Spaulding with us. You can read his piece in The Hill, Make American History National Again. More with him next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This Sunday, Lake Redden Park will be smoking as those crazy yellow-shirted asphalt cowboys fire up their barbecues for their annual Asphalt Cowboys Community Barbecue Fundraiser. Partake of the finest fire-grilled tri-tip or chicken, salad, cowboy beans, garlic bread, and a beverage. Eat it there or use the convenient drive-thru. Tickets are $15 at the event or pre-purchase for $13 from any Asphalt Cowboy. Redding Paint Mart or Lulu's Restaurant on Pine Street at Cypress Avenue. Lulu's serves great food and drinks at affordable prices 7 days a week. Soup, salad, sandwiches, steaks, seafood, and Italian dishes. Everything is made fresh daily at Lulu's. And you can order prime rib any time of the day. Plus, the very best Bloody Mary in town. Catering and banquet facilities are also available with customized menus to fit your budget. Join us this Sunday at Lake Redden Park between 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. for the annual Asphalt Cowboys Community Barbecue.
Get ready to be a part of a Palisadro tradition. The 45th annual Honeybee Festival is buzzing into the Bishop Quinn Community Center at 21893 Old 44 Drive in Palisadro, Saturday and Sunday, September 26th and 27th. Bring the whole family for a weekend packed with fun, including a craft fair. There will also be local businesses and vendors on hand, live music, delicious food, and plenty of activities for all ages. Enjoy the NorCal Antique Tractor and Engine Parade, the always popular Bee Costume Parade, and the live Bee Beer Demonstration. Start your morning with a delicious pancake breakfast for only $10, served from 8 to 10:30 both days. The festival is Saturday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Sunday, 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. And the best part, proceeds from the festival help support Palisadro Park. So don't miss the buzz. Join the fun at the 45th Annual Honeybee Festival, September 26th and 27th at Bishop Quinn Community Center in Palisadro. And special thanks to our main sponsor, Roof Savers.
Join me, Dr. Lauren, on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. behind the pink mic for breast cancer conversations about prevention and diagnosis to healing stories and words from expert guests. Behind the Pink Mic is proudly sponsored by Sizzle's Kitchen and Swell Endeavors. Tune in with Dr. Lauren every Tuesday at 6 p.m. on KCNR 96.5 FM, 1460 AM, and streaming at KCNR1460.com. Behind the Pink Mic, let's talk healing, hope, and community.
Guys, if you think antique stores aren't your thing, well, you've never been to Memory Lane Antiques Vintage and Collectibles at 1773 Highway 273 in the Shasta Gateway Center in Anderson. Sure, you'll find great furniture and home decor, but that's just the beginning. Check out fishing gear, hunting apparel and supplies, military and war memorabilia, beer steins, sports collectibles, jerseys, vintage photographs, some signed, and collectible trading cards. Whether you're a lifelong collector or just looking for something unique for your man cave, you'll find treasures around every corner. Browse shelves of classic DVDs, VHS movies, CDs, and books. Discover quality copper cookware that's built to last. Or pick up a few favorites from the Amish food section featuring jams and popcorn, even soaps and lotions. Memory Lane Antiques Vintage and Collectibles. Open Monday from 10 to 6, Thursday through Saturday 10 to 6, and Sunday from noon to 5. Closed Tuesday and Wednesday. Memory Lane Antiques Vintage and Collectibles at 1773 Highway 273 in the Shasta Gateway Center in Anderson. Listen.
This is Carl Bott. Join Linda and I Monday through Friday from 7 to 9 a.m. for Free Fire Radio. Find out what's happening in our town, our community, and our nation. That's Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 a.m. right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Your talk radio. Miss a day, miss a lot.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Dr. Matthew Spaulding continues with us. He is Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government. His essay at the Hill is called Make American History National Again. We're talking about what's happening at the National Museum of American History. Dr. Spaulding.
Let's step back briefly. Who's in charge of the Smithsonian, and how do they get there? Are they appointed?
It's a good question.
Hired, fired? Yeah, yeah. How does that happen?
It's kind of an oddball, if you want to think about it. So Smithson, his name is James Smithson, originally left this money in his estate in the early 19th century to create this museum, which became all the Smithsonian's, to expand knowledge. So over the course of time, then, it became these various museums. It has a semi-independent, but not completely independent existence. There's really nothing like it, which is why constitutionally, legally, it's hard to kind of get control of or assess how to deal with it within the constitutional structure. It is overseen by a board of regents. The regents are determined by law. It's actually the Smithsonian is created by Congress, so it's an entity of Congress. It's funded, I think, about $1 billion a year by Congress. But it's overseen by a board of regents. The head board of the board of regents is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. The Vice President of the United States is also on the board of regents. Then there are some senators and congressmen, some public appointees, all of whom have to be approved by Congress. The board of regents in turn hires a secretary of the Smithsonian, and the secretary of the Smithsonian in turn hires directors of individual museums. The current secretary, don't quote me on this, has been in there for some 10, 15 years. And the current director has been in the National Museum of American History some 5 or 6 years or something like that. I could be wrong on that. And then almost from the very beginning, again, going back to those documents that are in the White House report on the Smithsonian, you can just see if you look at the documents from the very beginning, from the moment the director came in, including a lot of her interviews beforehand and during, makes it very clear that she wanted to go in and change how American history is presented, how it's understood. She wanted to de-emphasize, de-center the narrative that we normally think of, the founders, these figures, de-center them and to reframe it, reinterpret it, deconstruct it, whatever terms we use nowadays, to tell a different story, which is not a story of history at all. It's a story of oppression. Mm-hmm. It's a story of oppressors and oppressed. It's a story of how the people have been subjected to this terrible thing. Well, those are all interesting questions to be debated in the faculty lounge, I suppose, but not at a National History Museum paid for by the American taxpayer that should be teaching Americans, including visitors from other countries who are tourists here, should be teaching the basic consensus story about what actually happened in reality, including the parts of it that are not the best parts, including some things that are very tragic and bad and that's part of the story, too. But so much of the story is overcoming those things and creating this great nation. But there are certain consensus events. I mean, for instance, you know, the colonial period, the Lexington Concord, the things I was mentioning earlier, that's not even told as a story. Yet I think that's unobjectionable and non-controversial.
Uh-huh. Dr. Matthew Spaulding with us from Hillsdale College, whose piece at the Hill, Make American History National Again, and also Testimony in Washington. You ultimately use this phrase, reflective patriotism. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the word patriotism has gotten a bum rap. You know, this notion that you should love your country. But I think that's actually a serious question, right? If you're a citizen, especially in a country which protects your freedoms, protects your liberty through the rule of law, you should come to appreciate it and love it. But having said that, it shouldn't be an unreflective love. It shouldn't be a knee-jerk reaction. It shouldn't be automatic. You got to think about it. And in a free country, especially one that in which we govern ourselves, it's important that it be reflective patriotism. Tocqueville makes this distinction in Democracy in America. our patriotism does not come from kind of the soil and merely ethnic connections,
right,
family
right.
relations, this kind of thing, as it might in, say, continental Europe. It becomes because we choose to be citizens of this republic, which means we have to reflect on it. And my point is, when you reflect on it truly, broadly, and you see that, yes, there were all sorts of things in our history, such as slavery, the most central, how the Indians were treated, that we rather don't like or reject or we're unfortunate in many ways because the practices were barbaric. And yet through that, if given a narrative to see what was, how they thought about it, how it was approached, how over time it changed, how this occurred, the context in which to understand those aspects of history, you can still see through all that, that this actually is an amazing country that's accomplished many great things, including overcoming those things, mm-hmm. such that I can actually love it. As we would say an uncle or someone in our family that we know are not perfect, but they're still ours and we love them. And we will do things to help them, to preserve them and perpetuate them.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean by reflective patriotism. And that's what the Smithsonian should teach. If someone visits there, they should have that sense about them when they leave.
Been a few weeks now. Has anyone at the Smithsonian appeared to be concerned about this, appeared to figure things out after testimony in the report? Perhaps some people who can't go public, but maybe are saying,
yeah,
you know what, you're right about this.
The most interesting thing about this is that, first of all, in the testimony, they also brought in the director mm-hmm. of the National Museum of American History, and she didn't do very well. It was defensive, but also didn't answer a lot of the questions and whatnot. But then since then, I've been struck by how the facts of the report, the narrative of the report about what it's saying, it's actually not been disproven.
Uh-huh.
It's not been rejected. It's caught up in the politics of the day. This is how national politics works. But having said that, the report itself is out there in
mm-hmm.
great length, standing of its own. So I don't know where this goes. This is a question for the regents. They're having a meeting coming up, I understand, in the fall. They're aware of the report. The report has gotten a lot of attention. And they have a fiduciary responsibility over that institution. So I think they've got to think about this very seriously. And I think they've got a choice to make, mm-hmm. which say this is not merely a mistake. This is not merely a partisan divide. The document makes it very clear this was an intentional reframing and reuse of the museum. And the regents need to decide, is that what they want to see happen? Is that what was intended? Is that what Congress is funding? Maybe Congress needs to speak with that question. But I'm very thankful that this report has brought this to everyone's attention by focusing on some particular objectionable things having to do with, you know, sex and gender and all sorts of odd uh-huh. things. But really the underlying problem, which is that there's no there. It's not about American history anymore. And that's the crime. The particular objective are the things that are objectionable. I write that those are the kind of the smoking gun left at the scene of the crime. But the real crime here is that National Museum of American History no longer teaches America's national history. And that strikes me as a great tragedy
mm-hmm.
in a nation such as ours that needs to make sure that citizens and the general public know that history so they can perpetuate its institutions, so they can correct its flaws, so they can improve it. But that's the central thing that museum should do and why it was created in the first place.
Dr. Matthew Spaulding is Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. You can read his piece at The Hill, Make American History National Again, and also find his testimony as well. Dr. Spaulding, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Great to be with you, Scott. Anytime.
Up next, Dr. Justin Jackson with us from Hillsdale College. His new book, along with colleague Dutton Carney, is The Elements of Analysis. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Your home deserves to look its absolute best. At Divine Shine, we provide professional window cleaning, pressure washing, soft washing, and complete exterior cleaning services for homes and businesses. From crystal clear windows to spotless driveways and beautifully refreshed home exteriors, our experienced team delivers results you'll notice immediately. Schedule your free estimate today by calling 530-900-3156. Again, that's 530-900-3156. Divine Shine, professional exterior cleaning you can count on.
Are you looking to take your business to the next level? Don't let staffing issues or HR red tape stop you from growing. The most successful businesses are those that have mastered their HR and staffing needs, and they have done it with O2 Employment Services. Finding qualified help is harder and more expensive than ever. HR regulations are getting more and more complex and confusing. For over 20 years, O2 has been providing the foundation successful businesses need to grow, assisting employers with their HR, payroll, workers' comp, benefits and staffing. Partnering with O2 gives you the expertise you need to manage your business and employees. Outsourcing your HR and staffing is no longer a luxury. It's a necessity for successful businesses, and it is more affordable than you think. Let O2 show you how we can help you reduce your HR complexities, hire the right talent, and get back to growing your business. Call O2 today at 530-223-4674 or visit us online at o2es.com.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300. A reputation for excellence since 1965.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa and Janet Chandler. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archive link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51.
In a Jefferson state of mind. This is Carl Bott and Ted Lighty.
We want to invite you to our show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right, even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up, fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
Everybody calls us a liar.
Could someone you know use a little extra comfort right now? Alliance Heating and Air is proud to team up with Lennox to bring Feel the Love to our community, a special program providing free heating and cooling systems to homeowners in need. A simple nomination can make a big difference. Nominate today at homecomfort.org or call 2212-642 Alliance Heating and Air, because everybody calls us 2212-642.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out more Hillsdale College audio at the Hillsdale College Podcast Network, more at podcast.hillsdale.edu, or wherever you find your audio, including YouTube. We're joined by Dr. Justin A. Jackson. He is English professor and Edry Seward Kennedy Chair in English here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Jackson, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Scott.
Also very excited to talk today about a new book that's been released, co-written with another Hillsdale English professor, Dutton Carney. It's The Elements of Analysis, An Introduction to Careful Reading. And this is about literary analysis. So let's begin there. What do you mean by literary analysis? What are we doing when we analyze a work of literature?
Yeah. Well, we could push that back, right? We could ask, what do we do by analyzing anything?
Mm-hmm.
And I like to say human beings, we are, you know, we have lots of definitions as to what human beings are, made in the image and likeness of God, political creatures, relational creatures, you name it. Okay. I think another category is we are creatures who make meaning. We will make meaning out of anything. Little kids, you know, in my church, little kids, they're taught to kiss the cross. And so then you'll see little kids, if they're here in your office and they see a cross anywhere, they'll go and they'll kiss it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you would go, well, that's not a cross, but guess what they see? They see a cross. Okay. That's what human, that's just what we do, right? You and I are sitting across from one another. I can see your face. I analyze your face. We do it all the time.
Uh-huh.
If I make a joke and it crashes and you're not smiling, then I know, oh, I've done a terrible thing here. Okay. But that's what we do. So that's all analysis is. Sometimes people get a little concerned when they hear the word analysis, because what it means is to kind of pull something apart to see how it works. How do the constituent parts make up the whole? Okay. That's it. That's all analysis is. We've talked about it before. I like small engines. I like tearing apart my small Honda mower engine. It's a thing of beauty. I love my Briggs & Stratton. It's nice, but they're very different. That's a very different experience of analysis of those two engines. Are some things similar in the two of them? Of course they are.
Mm-hmm.
Are some things different? Yes, but it's not until you start working through it where you go, oh, that's why this engine never fails.
Yes. Yeah.
This is why I get that sputtering here, but I'm never going to get it here. And if I do, I know that there's something stuck because it should never sputter. That's it. That's all analysis is. And if once we can get past the, oh, I don't know, the trauma, people have an allergy to the language of analysis. It's just important that people know we're always analyzing things.
Sure, sure.
Pulling something apart is not a bad thing. The question becomes, do you know how to put it back together?
Yeah. You identify two major concerns that students, readers have about approaching literary analysis. So that's the first one. The first one is this really what the author intended? Is my interpretation what the author wanted me to interpret? How much should we care about that? How much should we care about the intention of the author? And should we get more comfortable as we read more and more with the possibility that that interpretation, whatever it might be, is not the only one?
Yes. So I would say you would – it's funny. There's kind of an evolution of the literary scholar. You begin in your youth. This is what we have to deal with our students, and you've pinpointed it exactly. Is this what the author intended? And I just can only tell students, look, go become experts in the necromantic arts, and then you can answer that question. Okay. That's step one. And I don't mean to dismiss it, because I don't want to say, no, the author's intention doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, as a beginning scholar, you know nothing of the author. So are you going to go spend time reading four biographies, very different biographies? Are you going to spend time to go read the author's letters? Are you going to read the books in the author's library? Okay. If not, and you're not, because you're a freshman in a great books course, then we have to relax a little bit and just I always tell students, just bracket that concern. Are you going to know what the author intended? No. Are there different categories? Sure. You could ask, is this reading possible? Well, sure. Lots of readings are possible. Is it probable? Oh, that's a fun question. Is it demonstrable? Is another fun question. The first one, if possible, is, well, sure. And I think that's what scares people.
Yeah, yeah. There are so many possibilities.
Correct.
Right.
Then it becomes, is it demonstrable? And usually if there's a demonstration, there's going to be somewhat of a consistent pattern. So you ask students at first, like, good to be mindful that you're maybe, it's not the author's intentions, or the second, the other side of that coin is maybe I'm just making it up. Like, there's two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just give them freedom. Say, just make it up. Someday you may discover that your reading really is the exact opposite of what the author had in fact intended.
The second fear or concern you've touched on, which is essentially, I feel like I'm making it up.
Yeah.
There are so many possibilities. Why would I have the right one or a right one?
Yeah.
And you point out in the book, The Elements of Analysis, that it's important to look at this not as a debate, but as a dialogue among other readers who love the work. How does that change perhaps the way that we begin
or continue through our analysis?
Oh, gosh. Let me just say, I hope it changes the way we do analysis, because then you can just engage something in an intellectually honest way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about everyone else here, but if I know I'm entering a debate and it really is a fight, then I'm just there to win,
mm-hmm.
and I'll most likely win. I probably won't believe a word that I said, but I'll win. That to me is not humane.
Yeah.
That's not, it's fun for me, but that's just pugilism with language. Okay. That's not actual. Is it based on analysis? Yes. But do I have to buy the analysis? It turns out I do not. All right. So that's the difference between debate and argumentation. Argumentation, simple. You have a claim, you need support, and then you have to explain the way in which the support supports the claim. That's basic literary analysis. That's fun. So then, yes, then we're in a dialogue. And, you know, I don't know about you. I've learned more in my life through dialogue and conversation than I ever have through debate. Mm-hmm. Once I know something's a debate, then I'm short-circuiting all sorts of things, because
right.
I'm simply going to win. And if you go, well, can't you just cut that competitive spirit out of you? It turns out I cannot.
Mm-hmm.
I can't. If we're having a conversation, then all of a sudden it's, oh, I get to have fun. And it turns out I get to be riskier, because now I'm not afraid of winning. What if I've been nibbling on this idea in the back of my mind and I introduce it to you and I know it's questionable? And then you put a couple of pieces together for me there. It's like, oh, that to me is fun. That to me is a free inquiry, which is very much what the college is about, I think. We enter into these things. I, as a professor, have trust in my administration. I'm not to step on my toes and to allow me what I'm trained to do.
Yeah.
My administration trusts me to go and teach these students something about the Western tradition and lit analysis without any ideological intention of harming who they are and lying to them. And the students have trust in the professors and the administrators that we're there for their own intellectual and spiritual growth, though they may not see it. And the students are actually in the most precarious position here, because they have to trust these older people who were presenting them with things which their parents told them, don't ever think those thoughts.
Yeah.
And now here are those thoughts. Okay, that takes a ton of mm-hmm. trust. You can see why people are they are leery of analysis, because if you're breaking things down, the question becomes for St. Irenaeus, great, how are you putting it back together?
Mm-hmm.
That becomes the question. And so there is that great level of trust that we have here, that what we're putting back together, we're doing it in a very honest way. It may be incorrect, mind you,
yeah,
but it's honest.
Yeah.
And we all act with a sense of charity.
Dr. Justin Jackson continues with us next. His book, The Elements of Analysis, An Introduction to Careful Reading. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
My friends in Redding and Shasta County, it's your friend Gary Lavox here of Rascal Flats. And the best part about touring is seeing amazing places like Redding or Shasta County. Fantastic people like my friend Josh Barker and Josh Barker Real Estate. The price is always right with Josh Barker, because I think he's related to Bob Barker. Ha! See what I did there? Seriously though, Josh offers more options than anyone else, and he can prove it. See for yourself at his website and check out his hundreds of five-star reviews. Josh Barker Real Estate helped over 9,000 families buy or sell a home just like yours. Josh Barker Real Estate only hires full-time experienced agents to work with you every step of the way. So remember,
sell your home the easy way. Pick the price, pick the dates, and call Josh Barker Real Estate.
Shasta Lake and neighboring friends. The Queen of Dragons has your back with premium products at prices that work for you. As the longest standing dispensary in the area, our local team knows exactly what you need. Our shelves are stocked with the freshest flower in town. From our premium, fresh, and local line to our budget-friendly options featuring Emerald Junkies and Tricana Boys. Don't miss our famous Flower Friday deals. Top quality at unbeatable prices. And for the green thumbs out there, clones are now in store for the growing season. Join our Dragons Reward program and earn points with every purchase. Stop by 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake or call us for delivery at 530-276-9771 or check out our menu at thequeenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons, premium offerings, unbeatable value just for you.
The sea, blue, vast, ever in motion. You remember how you felt the sky and that breeze carrying the scent of the high seas. That sense of calm, tranquility, aware of your small place atop that deep blue ocean. Deep Blue by Casa Carrillo. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Hi, everybody. McGraw-Milhaven here, host of America at Night. Tune in each and every weeknight for a late-night conversation. We'll have interesting guests, informative conversations from people who have been there and have done that. Plus, we always have time for you, the listener, because we love late-night conversations. Be sure to tune in every weeknight from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. for the next America at Night with me, McGraw-Milhaven, right here on KCNR 1460 AM and 96.5 FM, your talk radio station.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Dr. Justin Jackson continues with us, along with his colleague, Dr. Dutton Carney, here at Hillsdale College. He's written a new book, The Elements of Analysis, An Introduction to Careful Reading. Dr. Jackson, there are, I guess we'll call them critics of literary analysis who simply might say, look, this, you're killing the fun. You're taking away the beauty and the joy of literature by saying you've got to go deeper. You've got to think about this in a different way. Does our careful analysis here actually serve to deepen our love of these works?
Well, I mean, you set that one up for me almost too easily, right? I mean, that's exactly, that would be my argument, is that, again, for the analogy, I can enjoy how my Honda mower runs. In fact, I bought it because my kids were coming of a certain age where I didn't want to actually have to muck around with the mower any longer. I wanted the auto start.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to think about now whenever I've had a couple of issues with it, what a thing of joy to take it apart.
Mm-hmm.
That's just it. So do I enjoy mowing my lawn with the Honda mower without having to know how it works? Absolutely. Did I watch one of my kids with a Briggs & Stratton and then move to the Honda mower? I did. Did they love it? They loved it. Did they care? They did not care one bit. But there is something reassuring for me in my love of small engines to be able to explain to them,
mm-hmm.
this is why it's superior. This is why it's great. They may not care about it, but that's not my problem. That's their problem.
Yeah.
That's a curiosity problem. You ought to want to know how your small engine works. I think you ought to want to know how a poem works. If something brings you to tears, you should probably want to know, how did it do that? I mean, I find that sort of thing, I don't know. I find that sort of thing really quite compelling. And don't get me wrong, I understand the other argument.
Dr. Justin Jackson continues with us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. What do you say to those who argue, claim that this analysis in some way harms the beauty of the work, that overanalyzing literature can take away from the enjoyment of a piece of work?
For those of you who think analysis destroys the beauty of literature, I have got really bad news for you. you are a romantic at heart. That is the romantic argument for why children ought not be in schoolrooms. Mm. Why are you destroying their life of everything by making them study it in books? Go out into a garden and dig for worms. Go fishing. Don't read a poem about fishing. Go fishing. And you're talking to, and I don't want to steal other people's thunder on campus, but I also won't name them because it is a bit of a scarlet letter. So I'll just say this. I'm probably the only romantic I know of on this campus. The other two or three shall go nameless. Because nobody likes the romantics here, except everybody wants to embrace all sorts of romantic sure. positions. Mm-hmm. But my position would be it takes an analytical mind to be able to discuss that you're actually a romantic.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can ask, so then what would a romantic hermeneutic look like of analysis? That's a fun question. But guess what faculty that would take to answer that? Not the romantic intuitive faculty. It would not take that. It would take the analytical faculty. And again, I'm not positing it one over the other. I think that both of them work beautifully. Mm-hmm. Indeed, I'll go one step further. I think the intuitive faculty, the faculty of the heart, the faculty of love, is by far the most important faculty of the, there's the romantic in me, of the human person. The rational faculty needs to be actually, when I say channeled through that faculty of the heart, I have no problem with that. But nevertheless, I'm still using my rational faculty. Mm-hmm. That's what analysis is ultimately arguing for, is that if we're in college, it may be a good place to exercise and hone and refine your rational faculty. Call me crazy on that one, but this may be the place wherein we can do that for 4 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
You recommend inside the book that readers keep a notebook as they're reading through literature. What should go into it? What should a reader be noticing, recording, questioning, collecting while reading?
Yeah, I mean that's one of those things where you'll just grow as a student of literature. You know, most of my students will come in and they'll say, I'm not doing well on your quizzes, and I let them use notebooks. That's my way of bribing them. And they'll say, I'm not doing well on quizzes and I'm taking notes. And my quizzes aren't difficult. And I'll say, well, how are you taking notes? And they're just essentially writing down details from the text.
Right.
They're trying to guess what's going to be on the quiz. Do not take notes in that way. It really is simply, does something strike you? Was there a funny line? Does something make you go, mark it. Why? Just jot down an idea for yourself. I tell my students you should have a table of contents for your notebook. You should date your entries. You should have themes for those so that you can find those quickly and easily whenever it comes time to write your paper. But the easiest question to ask for students whenever they're wanting to do something or they think they have an idea, they just have to ask the question why. So students will come into me and go, oh, I think I'm really interested in writing about Orpheus from Ovid's Metamorphoses. Orpheus. I'm like, okay, why? No, look, because I'm a music major. And I'll say, well, I'm glad you're a music major, and I understand the connection as to why a music major would want to study Orpheus, mm-hmm. But that's not really an answer for an analytical question.
Yeah.
Okay. So why? The student will just go, I don't know. Great. We'll leave it alone. Then I'll ask another student, same question, why? Because tears oftentimes are sadness in Ovid's poetry. And we begin this poem with tears. But are they sadness or what? I'm like, oh, okay, now we have something. Now we have an actual question. Then all I have to ask the student is, were there other details inside the poem that helped you to answer that question? If they say, no, I can't find anything, well, then that's nice because then you go, oh, maybe you're asking the wrong question.
Right.
If there are no answers to your question, maybe your question was just off. Maybe the poem doesn't care about it. And it was something that just interests you, much like being a music major. Mm-hmm. Now, if they keep pushing on this, and let's say I have a student who goes, oh, my gosh, I want to do this story because it reminds me of Adam and Eve. she's bitten by a snake and goes down. And my students know we do not do comparative analyses in my classes. That's just a recipe for disaster. It doesn't mean one can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean one shouldn't do that. It just means I'm a very lazy man. And there's only so many things I can do in trying to teach them logic and how to, and adding multiple texts like this with multiple religions. That's just too much for a 6-page paper. Like you could say, you could say nothing wonderfully, but you would be saying nothing. Okay. So they say that, but then I can still ask and say, okay, but you know, I don't want a comparative analysis. And they'll say, yeah, I wasn't going to write about Jesus and all of that. Great. But what was it? That he had to have a real, if there's a connection, Orpheus really did have to have a love. And then I'll say something like, you just said the word he really had to. Do you have doubts? Well, yeah, obvious. Oh, what are your doubts? Here and here. Oh, you can start to see a text taking, a paper taking shape. But all the paper is just a mapping out
mm-hmm.
of what our logical process was in coming to that reading. That's
right.
All it was. That's it. Now, if it took your logical process to figure out what happens in the text, that is to say plot, great, I'm glad you discovered that. But that's not analysis. You just figured out what was happening.
Yeah.
That's it. And sometimes that's a great breakthrough. For anyone, you know, who can figure out what's going on in Waiting for Godot, good for you. Good for you. But usually what we're interested in is analysis.
Yeah.
We're not worried with what happens, but how is it depicted?
Mm-hmm.
What's the craft of the poet in depicting that very thing?
Dr. Justin A. Jackson is English professor and Edry Seward Kennedy Chair in English here at Hillsdale College, along with his colleague, Dr. Dutton Carney from our English department. The new book is The Elements of Analysis, An Introduction to Careful Reading, shop.hillsdale.edu and elsewhere. Dr. Jackson, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Always great. Thanks, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Matthew Spaulding from Hillsdale in D.C. and Dr. Justin Jackson, co-author of the new book, The Elements of Analysis. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews, including with Justin Jackson today, at the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Join me, Mark Levin, weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. KCR, your talk radio.
Donald Trump is doing something that's never been done in American history.
Now, what Trump is trying to do all at once,
he wants to, what I call, reindustrialize America.
Mark Levin is on the radio.
KCNR, your talk radio.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. Have you been affected by some of the recent changes in business ownership here in Shasta and Tehama counties? These changes follow a national trend where national companies buy up locally owned small family companies and change the culture and staff and pricing of their product. That has occurred here in the North State also. Three locally owned propane companies have been purchased by large national companies. If you're like me and you prefer to deal with locally owned companies, you may be interested to know Shasta Gas Propane, which has been around for 28 years, now has the third generation working in the company. For locally owned, family operated service and care, give us a call at 530-365-3793. Thank you.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coach Master has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coach Master, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coach Master apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.